Failure is not an option.
What difference at this point does it make?
Nobody said it was going to be fun.
This is Real Talk, a fearless, poignant, and intrepid show where truth speaks louder than words. This is Real Talk with your host, Audrey Russo.
The shame, not of this world, so we live on the run. We keep our eyes set, on what is to come.
It happened before. It will happen again. It's just a question of when.
Time's a luxury we don't have.
This is Robert Spencer, the director of Jihad Watch and the author of Arab Winter Comes to America and Did Muhammad Exist? And you are listening to Audrey Russo on Real Talk.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, this is Audrey Russo, and you're listening to Real Talk. And that bumper was, of course, Rock the Casbah by The Clash. And you know, when you hear that, we're talking about Islam. My next guest is well acquainted with the evils Islam perpetrates on Christians globally. Raymond Ibrahim is a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, a Judith Friedman Rosen Writing Fellow at Middle East Forum, a Hoover Institution Media Fellow, and a CBN News contributor. He guest lectures at universities, briefs, governmental agencies such as the U.S. Strategic Command and the Defense Intelligence Agency, and has testified before Congress regarding the conceptual failures that dominate American discourse concerning Islam. He is the author of several books, including The Al-Qaeda Reader and his latest release, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. It's my great pleasure to give a Real Talk welcome back to Raymond Ibrahim.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Audrey. Thanks for having me. Happy to be back, and thanks for that intro. Yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, wow, we got a lot to talk about here. Look, many of the listeners have heard about the grooming gangs in the UK. Well, they call them grooming gangs, the sex slave gangs, from some of my guests in the UK. Then again, in the media in the States. Now, it's also going on throughout the Islamic world. But it's not an aberration in Islam, is it, Raymond?
No, it's not. And that's the thing. What happened in England... in the UK, it's amazing because, you know, it has its own context. Muslims there are the minorities, if anything. And it seems like some sort of crime racket. But, you go to the Islamic world where Muslims are the majority, and now you see the same sort of thing happening, except in this case with impunity, because, of course, the police and the authorities are also Muslim, so they tend to look the other way. But you'll recall, for example, the Boko Haram abduction of nearly some 300, I think mostly Christian Nigerian girls who the leader said were abducting them, were enslaving them, we're going to sell them as slaves, we're going to convert them, we're going to, you know, use them as concubines and whatever. And that sort of thing, of course, you know, doesn't end there either. And, you know, it was amazing to me about Nigeria in that it actually made it to the mainstream media. But Boko Haram had been doing that for many years, abducting women and raping them and whatnot. And so many other groups in Egypt, for example, where Christian Copts are about 10% of the population. A couple of years ago, a ring was exposed, a sex ring of, you know, where it was centered in a mosque where young Muslim boys would go and try to seduce and trick young teenage Coptic girls, just like the British ones at around the age of 11 and so, and then end up basically raping them, shaming them, forcing them to convert, and so forth. And, you know, if you really want to look at the continuity of all this, most of the people who were involved in this sex ring in England were of Pakistani origin. Now, you go to Pakistan, and this sort of thing is just rife, where, you know, Christians, Hindus are constantly being abducted, including little children, one as young as 2 years old, many around the age of 6 and 7, and just gang raped and basically sometimes killed, sometimes left for dead by gangs, gangs as in many numbers of Pakistani Muslim men. And so you can see that, in fact, one in England, an earlier anecdote of what happened to these 1,400 girls, this has been going on for a while, and some of it was exposed earlier. And at that point, one of the girls testified that one of the men that was doing that to her said, "This is not a problem because we do this to your kind back home," your kind being infidels or Christians, back home being Pakistan. So you have to understand that what happened there is certainly not an aberration. It's not its own standalone phenomenon, but it's part and parcel of a much deeper thing.
Wow. What I found also, which was even more twisted, if that wasn't twisted enough, was when all-female in Syria, an all-female jihad group pimping out enslaved infidel women to ISIS. That was incredible.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you have to ask yourself. If this has nothing to do with Islam, then how do you explain a particular phenomena such as this? And by the way, there's other anecdotes that happened in the West. In Australia a few years back, teams, as they were described, or gangs of Muslim youth rapists raped anywhere from 10 to 20 to 30 Australian girls. It happened in the United States, in Minnesota, a Somali gang, which was actually doing the same thing, abducting and forcing into sex slavery American girls. So the question here is, we're seeing a phenomena, a particular thing, and we're finding that the people who are doing this come from so many different countries. They look very differently. Some are black, some are Middle Eastern, some are Asian, some are European, and they speak different languages and different cultures, different socioeconomic, political conditions. So what is the common thread in all this? And if you want to be honest, it's that they all are Muslim. They all come from an Islamic background.
If you want to be honest, yeah, okay.
If you want to be honest.
That's right. you are absolutely a meticulous researcher and an Islam specialist, as I mentioned in the intro. What we continue to hear ad nauseum from world leaders is that ISIS is not Islamic and has nothing to do with Islam. Can you tell us why this is false?
This is absolutely false because it's absolutely okay. I'll give you this example. All right, let's not even. I mean, when someone like the president says that, he's referring to, you know, the massacres and the rapes and the beheadings. Okay, are these not Islamic? Well, they are Islamic. If you look in Islamic history, Islamic doctrine, in the Quran, in the Hadith, in the teachings of Muhammad, the history of the early righteous caliphs, all of this stuff just proliferates in those texts. But let's even look at some of the most graphic stuff. And the sad point is, even the most graphic stuff that even your average person, you probably won't even believe this has something to do with Islam. Even that has to do with Islam. So not just cutting a head, but mutilating it, holding it, laughing about it, throwing it around, putting your feet on a dead corpse and sticking the flag of Islam, saying there's no God but Allah, etc. All that traces back to Islamic teachings. And I'll give you one quick anecdote that's very famous in Islamic history. It's the death and slaughter of he's known in Islamic history as Abu Jahl, or because Muhammad called him father of ignorance, because he was such a strong foe of Islam. He resisted it. He didn't want people to convert to it and so forth. This guy was killed by a Muslim. His head was chopped off, and before he chopped his head off, he came up to him and mocked him, and he grabbed him by the beard and pulled it while he was laying on the ground dying anyway, this Abu Jahl, and he put his foot upon him, then he decapitated him, then because of the head, he couldn't carry it, he put rope through the ears and dragged it to the Prophet Muhammad, and then Prophet Muhammad was very happy. There was the Allahu Akbars, and the Quran even describes this anecdote by saying, and this is how God, Allah, healed the hearts of the believers and took the rage out, because they saw their foe, his head, decapitated. And to add to that, the angel Gabriel, who of course is a very prominent character in Islamic lore, comes up to Muhammad laughing at the sight of the head of Abu Jahl, saying, oh look, Prophet, you got an ear and an ear and a head for a bonus. And so what I'm saying is, all of these theatrics of triumphalism and laughter and, you know, sadism, even that which the IS, Islamic State, is doing, traces back and has anecdotes and has justification in Islamic texts, Islamic history. You have the angel Gabriel laughing and mocking at a head and poking at it, and Muhammad praising Allah for it. So, of course, even that you can see is part of it. So for someone like Obama to come and say they are not Islamic, you know, as usual when it comes to people talking about Islam, there's just one of two explanations. Either this person is a complete fool and just beyond ignorant, or this person is just lying. And so I'll leave it to you to decide which it is.
Well, well, listeners already know what I think that is, but well, you know, just mentioning that, because you wrote an excellent article, and I really encourage the listeners to read this article, but we'll take a little peek into it, the beheading infidels, how Allah heals the hearts of believers. And you had mentioned that some from that, what you just shared, what is this about healing the hearts of believers by beheadings? I'm trying to understand that. So they actually, what we saw recently, of course, just in the past couple of weeks, that the Australian authorities foiled a plan by ISIS to do what exactly a lot of us might be fearing, that they were they did some raids and they foiled this. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation, they reported that the plan involved kidnapping randomly select members of the public off the streets in Sydney and Brisbane, beheading them on camera and then releasing the recordings. Now, obviously, we're probably going to YouTube it. So there's, in their minds, a healing involved by doing this?
Well, of course, there's the propaganda aspect, which is also directed directly from the Quran, which is to strike terror into the hearts of the infidel. And so, you know, much of what's going on with the beheadings and the videotaping and dissemination is to terrify the infidel. But, and I'll quote it to you, the Quran 9:14 and 15 says this: fight them, a common theme. Allah will torment them with your hands, humiliate them, empower you over them, and heal the hearts of the believers, removing the rage from their hearts. So on the surface, this sounds, you know, okay, it's nice and abstract, it's just jihad once again. But that story that I gave you about Abu Jahl, that's the background of where this verse was, quote-unquote, revealed. And so this verse is describing what I was telling you. So to understand it, fight them, Allah will torment them with your hands, basically means mortally wounding and eventually decapitating that man. Humiliate them, which means pulling his beard. Empower you over them, which means standing on top of him, putting the flag of Islam. And then heal the hearts of the believers, removing the rage from their hearts at the sight of his decapitated head. Because that's what it says in the hadith. So basically what it comes down to is the idea behind this verse and behind what we're seeing is that pious Muslims are so full of zeal for Allah's cause that the only way their inflamed hearts can be at rest is to see those who oppose Allah and his prophet utterly crushed, humiliated, mutilated, decapitated. Then at that point, the hearts of the believers can be at ease and, as the Quran puts it, healed. And so this is the cult of jihad that people don't really talk about or understand. This is a blood cult, a death cult. And, you know, we're still getting the watered-down version. No, these are angry people who have grievances about, you know, colonialism or something like that. No, this is a much deeper thing. And, you know, and as long as, of course, as we whitewash it and ignore it and put it in false context, the more you're going to see it proliferate.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm laughing. It's just because I'm thinking about the left and the media usually report this as, well, the youth are rioting again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the youth. Okay. The youth are decapitating again.
Yeah, right. I understand that ISIS has been, you know, they're real busy bees. They created a jihad video game to inspire and train jihadis. I'm sorry, I'm laughing, but this is insane. Where the characters scream Allahu Akbar and behead their opponents. Gee, I wonder where they got that from. Raymond, I was wondering, is this for real? I mean, and can this be used also as a recruiting tool? I mean, you know,
well,
how impressionable youth are.
Well, alas, as usual, many of the absurd stories that come out of the Islamic world are, in fact, for real. So this is for real. This is, you know, just their way of, you know, thinking that they're being clever by taking infidel technology and infidel games, but using them for their own advantage. So, okay, young people like to play video games and violence and so forth. So we're going to put it in their heads to do it in the context of Allah and, you know, as you said, Allah Akbaring and chopping heads. And also, you have the option when you play the video game, if you really want to score brownie points, is you become a martyr. And you blow yourself up. So, of course, all of this is supposed to indoctrinate the little youth who plays it, and then eventually he goes brainwashed and maybe joins IS and finally carries out what he was playing in reality.
Gosh, yeah, sure, that's exactly what they're doing. They're using our technology, yeah, because they want to rock you back to, well, the caves, I guess. People are unreal. This is, you know, it's almost like a bad script, you know, but okay, it's real.
It has been one for 1,400 years.
Yeah, <it's, laughs> my gosh. And they're still, the left is still denying that this is real. I think that's, to me, more incredible. I want to discuss your article on the Salafis. Returning, this was really stunning and puzzling to me, to the mosques and the media in Egypt. And I'm shocked because, if I'm correct, they were part of the parliament with the Muslim Brotherhood under Morsi. Now, Egypt banned the Muslim Brotherhood, but what's puzzling is that they have no problem with the Salafis, who were basically of the same mindset. They wanted an Islamic State. Isn't that strange?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't
understand. Well, all right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the way to understand it is, if from the Egyptian context, the Muslim Brotherhood was banned and attacked and this and that, partially because of its Islamist agenda, but also for a number of other reasons. The main charges against them is that they're basically traitors to their country, they're helping foreign powers subvert Egypt, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's not that they kicked them out because they're, you know, Islamists. That's not the official narrative. It's something else. So the Salafis are not the Muslim Brotherhood. Yes, they are Islamists, so what's our gripe against them? So that's sort of been the you know, and it's difficult, of course, for Assisi or anyone else. Egypt is an Islamic country. You know, you're not going to ban them for that long. So he's probably, this is a move of, you know, what we see happening always, where the government tries to kind of olive branch with the Islamists, just like Mubarak did once with the Muslim Brotherhood during, you know, towards the end of his tenure, trying to reach a medium. You know, he gives them enough leeway, but they don't attack him personally and call him an apostate and this and that. So, and it, the bottom line is, Egypt is an Islamic country. You cannot ban or really put these guys out because they're Islamists. You know, Muslim Brotherhood, it's because of political issues. That's the official line. But these guys, they weren't part of it. And but of course, in the end, in my opinion, the Salafis, their mentality, their ideology is actually probably worse than the Muslim Brotherhood, or it's at least the same, but it's worse in that it's much more overt. I mean, the Islamic State are Salafis. That's the bottom line. They are people who want to emulate literally the life of Muhammad and the early, you know, caliphs and the companions and these guys, and that's what the Egyptian Salafis are. Of course, some of them are smarter to use taqiyya and not, you know, when it comes to the controversial stuff, they won't talk about it, like beheading infidels and this and that. But you can rest assured they're on board with that. They support it. They just know now is not the time to, you know, bring that card out. You have to have your own caliphate to do that. But as long as you're still under Sisi and this, you know, they're having their own little kind of diplomatic game going on.
And so I'm assuming that Sisi feels that they can keep these guys under control, but the Muslim Brotherhood, they were a problem.
Yeah, it's not just that. It's if you oppress them, you know, and you really ban them, then you have the people who are supporting them getting angry and calling you an apostate. And so my point is, the problem is it's fundamentally a Muslim country. You have to play by the Muslim paradigm. You can't just ban them because they're so pro-Islam. In fact, Sisi comes up and to right. legitimate himself, he talks about how Islamic he is, you see? So, yeah. That's why it's always a it's a no-win situation, because it's always like one step forward, two steps back.
Yeah, exactly. In bringing up Sisi, I just, if I may, one more thing about, I'm just curious, with a now President Sisi, will it be better? I don't even know if I could say better, but it would be for lack of a better term, would it be better for Coptic Christians now in Egypt, or? I mean, obviously better than under Morsi, but how much better?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's better. An overwhelming majority of Copts supported him because, you know, he's not an overt Islamist. You know, he at least says, you know, the proper things about equal citizenship, regardless of religion and so forth. So, you know, it's he's the better of two evils. I'm not saying he particularly is evil, but he's, you know, he's in reality, he has to deal with the Islamists of Egypt and all those huge numbers, millions of people. So he can't, you know, be seen as too nice to the Copts. And you know, it's probably, when it comes down to it, you know, it's a civilization, it's the country, it's the culture, it's not so much the leader. The leader can only do so much. And if he tries to do anything too drastic to reform things, then he gets ousted. So you're probably going to see more of the same, just not as overt as under the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah, I figured that. Also with Sisi, I'm just curious. How do you think the situation will be between Egypt now and Israel with President Sisi?
Well, the one good thing, and we saw this with the recent conflict between Israel and Hamas, is because Egypt, and to go back to this idea of the Muslim Brotherhood were being attacked, it's not so much because they're Islamists, but because they were sort of subverting Egypt. So the idea among Egyptians is the Brotherhood and Hamas, which of course is the Brotherhood, it's Palestinian wing, were all working undercover. So Egypt, Sisi, have absolutely no great love for Hamas, and they were more than happy to see what was happening to Hamas by Israel. So we're sort of changing in that direction, from the whole Arab world solidarity for any power that stands for Palestinians, to all these Arab leaders themselves are now seeing the dangers of these organizations and how they pose a direct danger to them. So they're starting to turn their back on places like Hamas and basically tell Israel, go ahead, destroy them. And so that's actually, I think, one of the few benefits from what's going on.
Yeah, I had a feeling that him, well, obviously, Morsi, we knew where he stood, especially, let me see, from his words. I figured that it might be a little bit better situation for Israel for that reason, which is good.
Right.
Raymond, where can the listeners follow and support your excellent work and purchase your books?
Well, the one-stop place would be my website, which is just my name, Raymond Ibrahim, IBRAHIM.com, or you can just Google my name, and it'll probably be the first website. My books are there. You can click. It'll go to Amazon. All my articles come up there and videos and such. There's also a donate button, which would be great. Anyone who wishes to donate, I'd appreciate that to help keep the website running.
Excellent. And you're also in the social networks, yes?
Yeah, also on Facebook, you just my name, and Twitter, same thing. I'm actually more active in Facebook lately, something that I used to eschew, but now I'm actually doing it more. So I put things on Facebook that I don't even put on my website. So because it's just easier and faster.
It is, and it's got a further reach, and I think the listeners.
Yeah, that too.
Exactly. And so, as always, in my after show, I will put all the links that Raymond just shared and any information, and I'll share them there for you, just in case you don't happen to be near a keyboard or have a pen handy. Raymond, thanks so much again for taking the time to share your assessments on these, and thanks for all you continue to do for the cause of truth and freedom. You will be back with us, yes?
Yes, I will. And thanks for having me, Audrey. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks so much. God bless, and have a great day. Bye.
You too. Take care.